Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations. This is episode 7 on Chester Barnard, Magnus Opus, The Functions of the Executive, first published in 1938. We are going to be talking about this book over two episodes, this and the next one. And in this one we're looking at parts 1 and 2 of the text, as it's quite large. For more information about the author and the topic, please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com and get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. This episode is brought to you with the support of the Innovation, Knowledge and Organizational Networks Research Center at the University of Warwick. My name is Dimitris, coming to you from Birmingham in the United Kingdom.
My name is Miranda, coming to you from Leamington Spa in the United Kingdom.
And my name is Ralph, coming to you from Cairns, Australia, down under.
Wow. I really love that we're still so early in the history of our podcast, because we get to have lots of milestones. And for instance, today is the first episode that is recorded over two consecutive days, but at the same time.
True.
Because Ralph is in Australia.
Yes, that's true. It's many different time zones now.
On some level, this feels a bit wrong, and I hope we will not cause a tear in the space-time fabric or something, but if we do, let's hope it will be worth it.
I'm sure it will.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Ralph, what kind of exotic creatures have you witnessed during your travels?
The most exotic were bats. They have bats with wingspans of about 4 feet that reside in the trees here, and they also, they've got some diseases associated with them, which of course is kind of risky, but just this whole idea of bats the size of, you know, bigger than small dogs is a little bit nerve-wracking. Also, I'm staying at a place that's named for kookaburras, and so the owner of the bed and breakfast yesterday was feeding the kookaburras at the edge of the terrace that the house is built on. So that was very interesting to have the kookaburras fly down from the trees and watch her feeding them. And they have, their beaks are big. They're about 3 inches long and quite sharp because they eat meat. So I thought that was kind of surprising.
That's so cool. I know I asked you this in an email. Have you seen any kangaroos?
Yes. We saw several in the outback. And then when we were taking the train from Alice Springs to Adelaide, we saw a couple out under the trees. I didn't see large numbers of them, but we have certainly seen a few.
That's great. All right. Let's give a short summary of the text, I think. I will start and then let's chip in. So the purpose of the functions of the executive is to provide something like a comprehensive theory of cooperative behavior in organizations, which apparently grew out of Barnard's dissatisfaction with the existing management theory of the day, which was basically scientific management. And see our episodes 1, 2, and 5 for that. And the way that scientific management failed to explain Barnard's own executive experiences, of which he had plenty working for the AT&T and the New Jersey Telephone Company. Most pressingly, he believed that the role of the environment has been overlooked and underexplored, and that as a result, rational models of organizations required revisions to account for this importance of the environment that he firmly believed in. Interestingly, I read that the thinking that went into this book, which is relatively sizable, actually emerged in the form of 8 lectures that he delivered at Lowell Institute in Boston. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any of those lectures because I was trying to find an audiobook version of this or a podcast of some sort to aid in preparation, but nothing is there, I'm afraid.
I believe that's a niche we're filling, is the podcast version of Barnard, because I couldn't find anything either.
No. Well, there will be one soon.
Yes.
So these structural or rational theories of organizations, such as those advocated, I think, primarily by Henri Fayol, whom we discussed in episode 2, they tend to rationalize organizations and their functions, emphasizing the things like proper alignment of people, processes, and technology, amongst other things. And the consequence of such a line of thinking is, of course, that there may be a better or best, i.e. the most rational way to manage these organizations. And I think hence the familiar one best way of Taylor here. And the key things in those theories are, I was thinking of this, I think, are division of labor, functionalization, and specialization. And Barnard found this lacking, and he emphasized cooperation and willingness to cooperate, communication, and perhaps most interestingly, purpose. So with these additions, the survival and longevity of organizations was no longer contingent on the quality of structure, as it was with especially Fayol. Go back to episode 2 to learn more about that, but more so upon maintaining a dynamic equilibrium in a constantly fluctuating environment. And because of this, I absolutely love this text. It's great in most places.
So if I can add to this very good summary, I would also say that Barnard has his works have the quality of adding to the picture characteristics of the individual, both on a biological and a more psychological level. And he also completes the picture by emphasizing the purpose of cooperative action, like the reason why organizations exist, which is something that I think, to my recollection, the previous authors haven't actually emphasized that much.
No, they haven't. I think you're correct here. Or at least not in such a way.
So he goes into like the basic philosophical questions, ontological questions of why do organizations exist? And I thought that was actually a good way of providing a complete picture from the bottom to the top.
Yeah, in fact, he not only does he use an ontological basis, he uses a biological basis that essentially organizations have to come together. You have to have groups of people come together because of their biological limitations, which he briefly summarizes. So I thought that was a very interesting way to look at that individual, the individual perspective and contribution to organizations.
I agree. That was such an interesting train of thought that he proposed. And we'll get to that. I don't think the word ontological is quite right here, not to confuse our philosophically inclined listeners. But he does... The whole thing starts with a quote from Aristotle's Metaphysics, which I was very happy to find there. And you can't see this final causation, this purpose. The purpose that Barnard puts forward is very similar to final causation of Aristotle, that the end towards which an organization is established or works towards. And I found it very interesting. Especially when he later, I don't want to jump ahead, but when he later puts forward this paradox of that organization ceases to exist if it does not fulfill the purpose, and equally it ceases to exist if it fulfills the purpose. So that was something to think about.
Yeah, and I thought his whole discussion, which we'll talk about later, I'm sure, about efficiency and effectiveness were really intriguing. The way he defines them much differently than you commonly see in management texts or business management texts.
Right, that was one of the key contributions that I gathered from secondary literature of his, that this distinction between efficiency and effectiveness.
Right, and I think that one of the things that distinguishes him from Fayol and Taylor is, I believe it was Miranda who pointed this out, he just doesn't take the organization for granted. You know, in other words, neither one of them really got too much into the details of why does this organization exist. And Barnard really, I think, emphasizes that you have to think about that, because then you get these whole that leads you into these issues about, well, how do you sustain cooperation, and how does an organization satisfy the needs of the members. So I really liked the fact that he emphasizes the individual. What the individual needs in the organization, because you really don't see that in either Fayol or, in the case of Taylor, it's mostly, well, if he gets paid well for doing the work and follows direction, then everything gets better. And maybe that was largely true in his day, but I think Barnard brings that extra dimension in about the needs of the individual members of the organization, which I think is fascinating.
In fact, he says that successful organizations are exceptions to the rule, and that most forms of organization fail or either at the onset or quickly thereafter, which was refreshing to see in a book that is entitled The Functions of the Executive.
Right, and I'm not sure what his basis for that is other than his personal experience, but it does demonstrate that balance that you were talking about, you know, his belief that's very fragile.
He does make these claims time to time that claims such as this about majority, not even majority, vast majority of organizations failing immediately. And then he had this other claim that most people in the employment pool will not be interested and willing to work for your organization. So you have to sort of pick from the ones that will be, who are a vast minority. And he presented a curious line of reasoning. But I think we're jumping ahead. So let's try to go through this the way he wrote it, more or less. So part one is concerned, I think, primarily with individuals and some very curious arguments about individuals. And he's looking at sort of the antecedents of cooperation. What did you think of his idea, of his description of how people work, this compound of capabilities and limitations?
I found it quite curious. I mean, there are some things that resonated, but there were many others which, I don't know, I was quite perplexed about. And maybe it was due to the idea that, or due to the fact that throughout his arguments, he says at the beginning, these are like the individual aspects, the biological aspects, the psychological aspect. But what I will not take into consideration in this part of my arguments is the social aspect. And I found it, I don't know, I can't really talk about people without talking about the social aspects. So I was kind of struggling in that sense.
Well, he does talk about it later, in the next, so chapter three.
Later, yes, at the beginning, I don't know, I felt it was missing, and I mean, it was completed later on, but
I agree, it was very peculiar.
Yeah, I struggled too with that, Miranda, just like you did, because as soon as you start saying, well, I'm going to look at organizations, but I'm not going to address the social aspects, even though he did, as you both point out, later, just when you say that, it starts making me worry about, okay, well, then can I trust your conclusions that you're going to draw from this? Or how far are you going to go down this path without bringing the social in? Because then I worry about, is your analysis going to be very sterile and therefore, you know, not recognizing there's a strong social component. So I think it was more of a warning than it really turned out to be significant, because he does cover it pretty quickly, so he doesn't get too far down that path of the social aspects. But I do think he doesn't cover all of the social reasons that people exist in organizations and kind of what goes on at the micro level. Although he does talk about, I thought was interesting, he talked about organizations can have sub-organizations and areas of voluntary cooperation within the organization, which I thought was interesting as well, because that's not, you know, Fayol and Taylor don't really address that.
So I think a summary of his conception of the individual was something along the lines of that individuals are singular, unique, independent, and this sort of an isolate whole entity, which embody lots of different forces and materials of both past and present. He talks about memory for a couple of paragraphs, which are physical, biological, and social. So this division of a human being into components, such as the body, the more primitive drives and the less primitive drives. And these are then superadded to the limited power of choice. He goes about discussing free will in, again, a slightly peculiar way. And that results in the purpose for which individuals bear personal responsibility. But later on, of course, he distinguishes between individual purpose and organizational purpose, which is actually quite fun. But this view of individuals as, I don't know, I'm struggling to come up with a metaphor, but it's almost like a capability that individuals have certain capabilities that work well in some environments and not so well in others. And then the job of is to sort of pick and mix which of the individuals with which of the attributes would work better in which circumstances. Something like that. It's very objectivist, I suppose.
Well, or neo-positivist, sort of break, you know, the idea that you can break things down in their constituent pieces and analyze them and kind of put them back together, which I think both Miranda and I, that leaves us cold, because it's, I don't think you can really analyze people that way. But I think he was trying to get to the, as you were talking about, Dimitri, the fact that people have these limitations, and therefore they come together in groups to specialize and accomplish things they couldn't do on their own. So I see why he's going down that path. It's just, I always get a little nervous with that, because I'm not sure when you analyze people that way, that it you can bring it back together and say, okay, well, therefore these things are so because of these parts that people have. So
I see the same point. And you know, if you think about it, he's just being overly analytical in this at this stage. You see a human being, so how can I analyze this? So obviously there's a body, then the body can do this, but not that. It can get cold or get too hot, thirsty, hungry. There are these limitations to functioning and capacity. And then, okay, so let's add some basic needs and then let's add some social needs. But this idea that people come into organizations in order to overcome limitations, that was, I think, the jewel of this section in part one, at least for me. It was a very unorthodox conception of why organizations forms. It's not in order to enhance profits or produce more stuff or enhance safety, these things, or for protection, whatever. But it's in order to overcome the limitations of, one, the body of the individuals, and two, overcome the limitations placed upon the individuals by the environment. What did you think of that? For me, that was very much an kind of a moment.
I agree that this was definitely the part of the text that I enjoyed the most, and that it would be definitely from the first parts my key takeaway. I found it fascinating how there is this idea that organizations exist because of a limitation, because of a need, without not going into the idea that organizations exist regardless of this need. And I think a lot of the thinkers in management do not focus enough on this point.
And I thought it was interesting that it really is a different way to look at organizations. It's not just about purely about profit or selling more shoes or something like that, but there's individual needs that need to be met. Now, I do think that's where if you're not looking at the social aspects, then you can kind of reach a dead end there. And I did think it was personally curious. I don't think in a bad sort of way, but curious that he really just emphasized this, I've got these physical limitations, this is why I come together with people, because I think you could find many other individual motivations. But I think he's trying to find a way to answer his question about why organizations exist and what are the, you know, why cooperation is so important and where the stability in organizations occurs. And I completely agree with his point that it's not just about the sort of the things that are in corporate communications about, you know, we need to make more profit for shareholders and stockholders and that sort of thing. So I think it was, and if you remember, he's writing back in the, you know, early 20th century. So I think that was very new for its time. Nobody was looking at organizations that way. So I thought it was a refreshing approach.
I think it's also interesting how he doesn't conceive the idea that organizations undertake certain processes or certain decisions in order to survive. So he contemplates the idea that organizations may fail, and that is part of the life of organizations once they don't fulfill a need anymore. So to a certain extent, I find it quite revolutionary.
Yes, we tend to observe that management scholarship tries to cling on to the idea of continuing with the organization, I think, but claiming that, you know, if it's done, it's done, essentially. It's enlightening, I guess. It's definitely something different and something that maybe takes a lot of the pressure off.
I mean, how many organizations have undergone like radical changes, even, I don't know, in complete contrast with their initial identity, just to survive?
Well, he likes the example of the Roman Catholic Church. That would probably qualify for this as well. But other than that, he is very skeptical about. It's interesting, though, that he writes in one place in the beginning, he says that there aren't many organizations that are over 200 years old. And I thought, what? Wait, no. I mean, except Roman Catholic Church. And then I realized that he's writing in America in 1920s or so. And sure, from where he's writing, there weren't many organizations that were over 200 years old at that point. But back in the old world, we have the East India Trading Company and old classical multinationals and various still at that time imperial governments and that sort of thing. So there were a few organizations that were considerably older that he didn't address. But I don't think that undermines his point. It was just a peculiarity in the writing that betrays his geopolitical and temporal location. Coming back to the individuals, he has this in conjunction with the opinion that individuals are limited by themselves and their environments. He has an interesting perspective on how choices are made and decision making and all that sort of thing. And he says, and actually goes over a few pages. On page 14, he says, limitation of possibilities is necessary to choice. So constraining the environment. And this was reminiscent of episode 4 when we did the routines, as well as Weber, I think, in the previous episode. And then he says, the process of decision, as we shall see, are largely techniques for narrowing choice. And then he goes on page 15 to say that the narrow limitations within which choice is a possibility are those which are imposed jointly by physical, biological, and social factors. And this sort of evolves on page 16 into summary of how he sees people in organizations, which is persons as participants in specific cooperative systems are regarded in their purely functional aspects as phases of cooperation, which was a big boom. So you say about, you talk about things like constraining choices and the choice is a matter of imposing limitations on the options, and then that somehow transforms into when you're in an organization, you are not an individual any longer, you're a phase of cooperation.
Yeah, I thought that was an interesting way to describe individuals, although I will say that I started feeling better when he was talking about the social and biological, because now I can see he's putting those parts back together again. So I felt better about that, given that he sees people as whole beings and not just a functional slot in an organization. But I did think that was kind of, like you said, it was kind of a boom. You just look at this and you say, really, phases of cooperation? Interesting.
That would be an interesting title to come to work with.
Yeah, really.
Phase of cooperation 1284. To the shop floor, please.
Well, and what the other thing I like about that is he goes through that, I think it's a really good argument, a reasoned argument. And then he finishes up on page 17 with saying, persons choose whether or not they will enter into a specific cooperative system. And you don't really see that sort of personal individual choice in Fayol or even Weber or Taylor. And so I thought, to me, so I think personal agency and personal choice is very important in organizations. I'm looking at that and I was thinking, yes, somebody's talking about the personal agency. I thought it was good.
Yes. It's tricky with Bernard because he says all these things, some of which are, like this, and then others are less pleasing. But he always gives a number of caveats that when you read him, it's like, okay, so you want to separate an individual into these three constituent parts. Okay. And then he explains why, and you're like, all right, let's go with it. So it's it leaves this unusual sort of an aftertaste. Because at the same moment as he says that individuals are free to join any system of cooperation that they please, he, to an equal extent, says that, first of all, most of them will not be interested in doing that. And then he says that the moment they do that, they are phases of cooperation rather than the individuals.
So I have a question for both of you with regard to this idea of freedom, of choice, and so on. If you go to page 21, he talks about the two conflicting philosophical views on freedom of choice, will. What I was just wondering is, I don't know, I found this part a bit confusing, so I wanted to know what you thought about it. Because he says that there are these two different philosophies, and then he also says that his purpose, he doesn't intend to reconcile them. I undertake no reconciliation of the opposition in these philosophies.
Can you say about what the philosophies are?
So
yeah, that would help because I don't have the text right in front of me.
Okay, no, that's fine. So from what I gather, he states that there are two philosophies at the basis of human behavior. And one denies freedom of choice or will, and the other basically acknowledges freedom of choice and will. And they make the individual an independent identity, ignoring the physical and social environments, or at least putting them into a secondary position.
Well, I suppose it's the classic distinction between determinism and something like existentialism, where on the one hand, individuals are determined, and here it of course depends whether by some metaphysical forces or by perhaps just their previous choices, or if you want to go to India, then karma. And on the other hand, in 1920s, there were, I mean, yeah, there were existentialists, of course, Kierkegaard was way before that, who basically say that you're free to do whatever you want, and it is your responsibility to assume responsibility for whatever it is that you do. And yes, I see that bit now, where he says, it's quite clever, I think, because he finishes this paragraph by saying that it is precisely the function of the executive to facilitate the synthesis in concrete action of contradictory forces, to reconcile conflicting forces, instincts, interests, and so on and so forth. That he recognizes the debate between the two is certainly not is not to take place in this work. And perhaps he observed the effects of both of these philosophies in real life. And as Ralph pointed out, that, okay, so individuals are free to join any system of cooperation, but not really. And converse also applies, that you're not forced into, usually, an organization, and you do have a degree of choice. So I think he's recognizing these constraints placed upon individuals by the consequences of their choices. And he's saying that as a manager, basically you have to dance around that and make it work in a way that matters for the organization.
So at the end of the day, he doesn't really take a kind of philosophical position between the two, but he just says, what's the manager's job in this situation?
Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I think he's arguing that there's no way to fully reconcile them, so he's not even going to try. And it's, as Demetrius was saying, it's up to managers. You know, he used the words reconcile, and I think maybe a better term, but this is maybe just me reading into it, is balance. You know, I think reconcile can also convey the notion of balance, and that there's no one solution or one size fits all, which sort of contrasts with the Taylor notion. And the thing that struck me about that, which I also wrote down that was the text that I had written down too, and about the function of the executive, because that, you know, that's the title of the book. You sort of get your antenna up when you see something that says that in the text. One thing that left me slightly unfulfilled though is that I think he's still taking a very top down approach to organizations, because to me that reads like management does all the thinking. And in maybe classical organizations or organizations of his age, you know, that was the case. But I think in our more modern organizations, we have a more expanded view of the participatory benefits of having employees make some of these choices and help people reconcile stuff. And that maybe the reconciliation has to happen at the individual level. The managers can't fully reconcile it. But I think that's one of the reasons today why you want to get a very strong overlap or synchronicity between the things, the goals and aspirations and desires individuals and organizations have with the organizational purpose. And there's organizations like Zappos that try to make sure so that's why we talk about things like fit, you know, and Zappos talks about their whole HR process is focused on getting the best fit for people in the organization. So I think he's leaving a little bit out. I'm not trying to criticize him too much with the 21st century understanding of organizations, but I do think he's kind of writing at his time and sort of that conception of organizations.
Do you think we could remedy this by suggesting that executive isn't necessarily a manager, but anyone who executes an action with regard to the organization? Or do you think this would not apply any longer?
Absolutely. If you talk about, now if you're thinking of the executive being, yes, I agree. My criticism would be much less, because now if you think about executive not being a person or embodied in a particular individual or office, and then it's more of an the executive action or the executive functions that have to be carried out, then I think it would be just as applicable today.
But then sort of thinking back on that, can a phase of cooperation be an executive at the same time?
It's not clear. I'm not sure you could say that one way or the other based on what he writes. I mean, I think you can look at it and say, okay, the executive's a person, somebody who's doing something. That seems to be the way he's writing. He's not really talking about distributed leadership in throughout the book. So maybe that's not what the text is would be. You know, that's probably the main interpretation of that text. But I do think you can look at it that way and say, well, so maybe it wasn't what Bernard had in mind. But I think if you say, well, the executive is more, you know, a set of functions that something or some group has to execute. I mean, he does talk about the importance of cooperation and its limitations and how people engage in the cooperation. So I think you could conclude that. I can't really say if it's the definitive way.
I'm just wondering about this, but I guess it's not particularly relevant to the reading. Because then I was wondering, okay, so if employees are phases of cooperation, what is the CEO? Presumably CEO would be a phase of cooperation as well, right? Makes sense. Just a more macro guiding type of cooperation.
Yeah, and he doesn't really address issues of power. You know, this idea that it's all cooperative, but he ignores the right way to say it, but he really does not develop that very far, this idea that, okay, so you have these phases of cooperation, but in organizations of any kind, certain people have become the locus of power in the organization in decision making. I believe he sidesteps a lot of that. And so I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing or a deficiency, but I do think it's a gap.
Well, you read the whole thing. I only read so far parts 1 and 2, but in part 3, I see there's a section entitled The Theory of Authority. So maybe there?
Yeah, some. There's some there.
We'll see. We'll see next
time. Just kind of late in the book. Yeah, we'll see when the next conversation, but it's kind of late in the book. I'm saying to just say, oh, it's all about cooperation and leave authority way to the back end, because that's a sort of a disjointed way of looking at organizations.
I was just going to say that in my reading, I saw the general group of employees as those who are kind of like coordinated by the executive. So I didn't really ask myself that question, and I just thought that the executive was a kind of managerial elite that had to deal with the issues and with the purpose of coordinating the employees in order to fulfill the need that the organization, by which the organization exists.
I agree. I think he absolutely thinks of the executive as the executive.
Yes, that's the way he seems to be writing.
And, probably a guy.
I do agree that if we were to extend this work to today's organizations, this is definitely one of the shortcomings, in the sense that the way in which organizations reach coordination of contradictory forces or reconcile conflicting forces, instincts, and so on, can actually be achieved by more subtle, by less authoritative means.
I feel maybe we should take a step back a little bit and define, or at least explain, some of the terms we're using, because we kind of just went for it with these cooperative systems and stuff like that. Because as you pointed out, Ralph, his terminology is somewhat counterintuitive here and there.
What did you think about the language used throughout the book? Because to be honest, I had never read the original version. I had read a translated version. So it was the first time I had come across like the original words used. I was wondering what you thought.
I thought it was I really don't want to put the wrong message across by saying pretentious, but maybe pseudo-academic or pseudo-philosophical. Like, this, most of part one, and I must say I did enjoy it with a certain effort applied, but most of part one needn't have been there. I mean, he spends most of this time dividing an individual into these three chunks that later on have only marginal importance to his argument. Maybe it pays dividends in parts 3 and 4 that we'll discuss in episode 8, but certainly it didn't bear that much upon the argument here. So after slogging through part 1, it sort of picked up, I think. Started talking about organizations and formal organizations and informal and structures. That was a bit more to the point, but I think I don't know what he was trying to do or not, but reading this, it was It was a bit too complex to for no reason, I suppose. It was just taking ages to explain that he's not going to talk about the free will, or that he's not going to talk about what the individuals are, and then spending like 20 pages talking about what the individuals are.
Yeah, that was a bit of a surprise. So my general impression is, I think, similar to both of yours. He seems to write in what was probably common at the day, this conversational style. So it's not really like he's, at the first part of the book, certainly for chapters 1 and 2, like he's developing an argument and defending it. He's basically, it's almost like he's having this conversation about, well, here's what I'm thinking about, here's the things I'm going to go into, here's some of these divisions of the individual. So for me, he didn't really, I hesitate to say this, but didn't really get to the point until chapter 3, you know. So there's all sort of this preliminary stuff that I don't think really helps his argument, or really, he's not making his argument, so I guess I shouldn't say it doesn't help it. But it's in chapter 3 where he gets to the key questions he's trying to address, which are, you know, why is cooperation effective? You know, what are the objects of the cooperative process, the limitations, instability, and then what's the effect of the cooperation on the ends that the organization is seeking? So I think I'm agreeing with you in saying, both of you, by saying, take them a while to get around to, all right, here's what I'm going to say, and I'm going to go, you know, deeper in that. And I think it picks up from there, but each chapter has some of that, what I tend to call wandering around. So that it is a bit of a slog sometimes.
What do you think, Miranda?
I found some parts quite abstract and philosophical, and then some parts were more concrete, down to earth. So, and definitely in terms of like general structure, it wasn't direct, straight to the point. It was, as you say, walking around, wandering around the concepts.
Yes, that must be what my supervisors think of my writing. Now I know. Because you recited comments from the latest meeting almost verbatim.
No, I wasn't there. I didn't know.
Oh, it's like we were a mouse in your pocket, as we say in these days.
Yes. Right. So I want to try to summarize what he means by a cooperative system, since this is pretty much the key argument of the whole text. And it's something like an amalgam composed of various interpersonal coordinated activities of people, or phases of coordination, I suppose. And at the same time, it's a social process by which social actions are accomplished.
Yes, I think that's a reason.
Yeah.
And, he also mentions that there is a change in the relationship of one part to any or all of the other changes in the cooperative system. So there is an acknowledgement of relations between parts. It's not in terms of asymmetric relationships, such as power would be, but they're not isolated, even though they're composed of isolated individuals. Within the cooperative systems, it's interesting how he defines social contribution, and I think this goes to one of the key points of this part. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the social contribution is one of the primary factors in maintaining this system of cooperation, because it elicits physical energy from other participants, and this physical energy, so following his categorization of the human being, this physical energy is then converted into material, so stuff like products. And because of that, because individuals are phases of cooperation, and that they convert physical energy of themselves and others through the social into the material, he argues that you can't really impute to any individual a definitive product, or a definite product rather. So assigning things like number of units per individual produced per unit of time is not correct in Barnard's world, because everyone contributes to the production in different ways and through different factors. So a manager exercising a social function onto the employees equally contributes to the production of any goods or services that the organization produces, even though he or she may not be directly involved in the assembly or...
Do you know what I found quite interesting now that you were talking about this? Is that there is this kind of like idea that each individual possesses a sort of some specific kind of energy, some special kind of energy. I know it seems a bit metaphysical, but I found it quite fascinating in terms of choice of words.
No, go ahead. Can you say more?
Well, I think the best part that goes on about this is actually at the beginning in the introduction, where when Vanad talks about defines individuals, he says on page 11, as physical objects, they cannot occupy the same space. There is an interchange of radiant energy between them. They reflect light to each other. And at the beginning, I found it quite surprising, because I don't really see individuals as people that possess energy. I found it quite strange, to be very, very honest. But then reading throughout the work, this idea of individuals cooperating and being part of this cooperative action because they can contribute with their energy to an organization which exists because it overcomes this need, it started to make sense.
I think I get what you're referring to. I think it's because later on he says that, and by the way, yes, this is an excellent point. It's almost spiritual how he describes it, is because he believes that organizations are, as with systems theory, are more than sums of their parts. So he believes that, I think on page 79, which is jumping ahead a bit, but still, that organization creates something new in the world that is more or less of different quantity and quality from anything that would have resulted from just putting those people together. And this is a persistent argument. So maybe when speaking of peoples as energies, it's some sort of an argument that they are the fuel that creates this new thing that is the organization that is more than them, that is above the collection of those individuals. But I completely missed that in connection to the introductory bit that you just mentioned.
I mean, when have we ever heard human beings described as energy, like in management scholarship? We've always seen production factors.
Right, or I was just going to say in management scholarship, radiant energy. I don't think you ever, ever see stuff like that. I do think that
somewhere
was...
Somewhere else.
I think that was necessary, though, for him to be able to emphasize the importance of cooperation, right? That, you know, people are coming in organizations as individuals, and you don't just command them to do things. They aren't just this, you know, an army of robots to go do things. That they have individual needs, and they can leave the organization when they want to. I think, if you're doing... So what I liked was he's stepping above the very low-skilled work that Taylor had a lot of experience in. In realizing, I mean, you might even say that's sort of a foreshadowing of the knowledge worker, right? That that somebody can be an organization if they want to be and contribute if they want to because of this energy that they have, and whether and that could be physical capability, or that, and that's what Taylor looked at almost exclusively, or it could be creative energy and knowledge and experience. I think that's Bernard had to go to that level of abstraction because he's trying to talk about all organizations, not just, you know, particular industry, particular group. And so I actually didn't think that was as important until Miranda pointed it out. Now I see that's very important for his arguments.
I agree. I'm glad that you added in management scholarship at the end of that sentence, Miranda, because I was already about to say that I hear that on a daily basis, that people are energy. But absolutely, in management, what would that even mean? That people are energy. It's, as you pointed out, when speaking of resources or phases of cooperation or any such thing, then this statement doesn't contribute.
So one of the other things that struck me, and I found this in chapter 3, was he talked about limitations, right? So he starts out talking about limitations of individuals and how coming together in organizations helps them overcome their limitations. And then he goes on to say, and this was on page 29 in chapter 3, that essentially all organizations have their limitations, such that the very process which produces effectiveness in one respect is usually also the cause of ineffectiveness in the other. I thought that was fascinating insight, that organizations or and groups of people can be really good at some things, but not very good in others. And so that same individual strengths and weaknesses way of looking at people also relates to the results of their cooperative effort. I thought that was a really interesting insight.
I agree. And before that, on page 23, he sort of preempts that by saying that limitation is a function of the total situation viewed from the standpoint of a purpose, and that was great.
And my perspective is that's great because it means you have to look at the purposes of the organization and say, okay, so if you know your people may have this sort of collective weakness or limitation, but if that's not what the organization has come together for, it's not really important, right? So the importance of a limitation relates to what impact it has on the organization's purpose. Another interesting point from chapter 3 for me was he talks about instability in organizations. This is the first time that we're seeing this in management literature, because Fayol doesn't really talk about instability. He talks about the planning and control and those kinds of things. And Taylor doesn't really talk about, I think one of the things we mentioned was he doesn't talk about the external environment. And so Bernard is actually specifically acknowledging in chapter 3, and I found it on page 36, that this instability comes from the physical environment and uncertainty and adjustments in the managerial processes and expansion in the number and range of organizational purposes as they change over time. I mean, that's fascinating that he talks about there's this within the nucleus or this concept of organizations is embedded this idea that they can be unstable. And there's these various factors that can make them unstable. So I thought that was a very interesting insight.
Yes, in fact, he says that systems of cooperation are never stable because of changes in the environment and the evolution of new purposes. So that is very key to this, that it's not as longevity of the organization is no longer a function of how well it is built. It's rather of how it adapts to the instability of the environment it's dealing with. And I remember you surfacing similar points when we were discussing routines in episode 4, that okay, the assumption of a stable environment is all well and good, but it doesn't work that way, even in places where the environment would probably be assumed to be stable.
Yeah, I tend to catch on right away when people talk about stability or instability, because in my work experience in the Navy and high reliability organizations, it's all about being you can't create long-term stability. You can create micro levels of stability, but you always have to be adjusting because of all the changes, not only in the environment, but internally and socially, as Miranda was talking about later. Even internally in the organization, it's not stable in sort of a macro sense, but you can find micro levels of stability.
What would a stable environment even look like? I mean, isn't the stability or instability of the environment merely a reading of the instruments that measure that? So perception.
I think that's largely true. Although, remember, you got to look at the time that he was writing. The world was much less integrated and much less international, and the communications outside of organizations and across countries was much less. And so, I think you didn't see change as rapid as you do now. And so I think we're kind of a product of that, because it's hard for us to even imagine what stability would look like. But I'll give you a quick analogy in that in the United States in World War II, they essentially nationalized all the U.S. industries for the war effort. And then at the end of the war, there's this huge pent-up consumer demand because the United States stopped making automobiles, for example, in, I think, 1941. And so there wasn't a whole lot of focus on what consumers wanted. It's sort of the Henry Ford idea. You can have any color car as long as it's black. And so there was a lot of just cranking out the same stuff over and over again. And the consumers were so hungry for it, and the demand had been pent up and unsatisfied for so long, that they would take largely whatever you produced. And now it's, if you've ever been around a car that was produced in that time frame because it's an antique or some kind of collectible, or you know somebody has them. They're, it's hard to even say they're the same kind of vehicle now, or same kind of thing as the cars that we sell today, because there's and I'm not talking about just the safety aspects and just how they're constructed, but just the quality of them. And I think that might be one example where you don't have a lot of competitors, and you don't have to really pay attention that I won't say pay attention, but the voice of the consumer isn't really a strong driver in what you produce. So that would be an example, but we don't see much of that anymore.
I don't know, because he was writing around the time of the Jazz Age, and at that point, things like transatlantic transportation, the telegraph, the telephone, all that kind of stuff, they were very much on the rise. So if anything, the environment was significantly changing. People had more disposable income, the social structure and gender relations changes following World War One. This isn't what I'm drawing this from, but if you watch Downton Abbey and follow through how how their life changes in the exact same period as Bernard was gathering his thoughts for this book, then it was highly unpredictable in many ways.
I think you're right about that. So I was just given one small example that is probably, but there's lots of other change that was going on at the same time. So I think you're right. It's, if you talk about, I think you have a good insight there that a lot of these writers talk about sort of stable environments, or certainly not Bernard, but they're not really talking about the dynamics of what's going on. And that was probably an illusion whenever they wrote about it.
That's all for part one of episode 7. Thank you for listening. Please visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com for information on part 2, future episodes, and a bonus video message from Ralph. If you enjoyed the first part of this episode, please leave us a positive review on iTunes, subscribe to our feed, and tell your friends and colleagues about this podcast. You can also get in touch with us on our website, via Twitter or Facebook, as well as on LinkedIn. Thank you, and we hope to see you next week as we conclude our discussion of the first half of this true classic that is The Functions of the Executive by Chester Bernard, here on Talking About Organizations.